Okay, so we're just starting the second tape, and we were talking about the events at the UN on December 31st, 1991, when you were doing the final hours of the negotiating on the El Salvadorian peace process.
Right, well, as I mentioned before, we sort of receive assurances from the two sides that we could go back to the Secretary General's map room to discuss, to give him guarantees that they would keep working the next 5 hours and so, 5 hours and 30 minutes. And they asked for support of the UN team to, in order to put together some ideas on issues that were pending, like agrarian reform issues and the national police. And so we were able, the 4+1, back to go back to the Secretary General and give him guarantees that in 5 hours and a half, but we asked him not to leave the building, so we could ask him to, at one point or another, his guidance, his own views, if it was necessary for him to talk to the... So he told us, you know, well, I'm going to leave the building. And we said, no, you're not going to leave the building. We need you in this building. Right. We need you in this building for practical purposes. Yeah. And yes, I think in that sense, the 4+1 were a little bit tough with the Secretary General in the last hours, but we thought that was necessary. And in Pérez de Cuellar, to be very honest, although he was not feeling well, although he was on very strong pressure of his own family, his own wife, he stayed there, and we all had pizzas and sandwiches and so on and so forth, and we were able to have everything together almost 11:45 and to go back to his own map room, where the final signature took place 1 minute before midnight.
And it wasn't it wasn't like 1:45, it really was midnight.
It was exactly 1 minute before midnight.
It was
just amazing.
Okay.
And I was very worried about the fact that I knew very well Javier Pérez de Cuellar, and I knew that he was very straight and very strict with these kind of things. And I knew that midnight he was going to leave the building. And so that's why, obviously, he left the building, let's say, around 12:30, after we sort of celebrate, discuss,
and so on.
But they say the formal work he finished before midnight.
Okay.
This is for history, records, you know, and that helped us, you know, as well with the two parties, to make them feel that this was the last chance, the last opportunity. I mean, and the Secretary General was not playing games, and we were not playing games, you know, and it was their country after all, you know. I mean, we like very much the Salvadorians, but he was not a Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
He's Venezuelan, he's from the U.S., you know, so we don't... We care a lot about you, but it's your sons and daughters, the ones that are dying, not ours, you know.
Yes,
so
yes.
We used a lot that type of lines, you know, on the last minute, you know, because that was the only way for them to walk the extra mile, you know.
Right.
And we knew that it was difficult. I'm not saying it was it was simple. It was difficult. So it was painful as well, and they knew very well, if I give this, how am I going to explain to my own galleries tomorrow, to my own people tomorrow, and after all, we were fighting for this, one side or the other, and now we are giving up. Yes, negotiation is that, give and take, you know, and it was very complicated, especially because they had no choice. That was the thing, and that's why I... still recognizing that the maturity of both sides, especially the maturity of President Cristiani, because the authority was Cristiani, the president was Cristiani, the one had been elected was Cristiani, the other one were rebels, and playing for their own cause, you know. But Cristiani, at this day, you know, for me, deserves the high recognition of what why the peace process was.
Yeah. Now, the final agreement was signed here in Mexico in Chapultepec in January.
That's 16 days later. Yes.
16 days later.
Yes.
Why was it set up that way? Were there some issues that still had some fine tuning to be made, or?
In fact, yes, there were some few details about that were necessary to put together, minor things that really didn't need for both sides to remain in New York. But
okay.
It was more, I would say, the format of the agreements, more than anything else.
Okay.
So, and the fact that the new Secretary General was taking office on the 1st of January, and so it was decided that the sooner the better.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned before, the both sides decided it was Mexico City.
Okay.
Something right. That some of the friends were sort of expecting that other capital. We the Mexicans didn't push at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mexico City as a place to design. Both sides came to approach me, and I said, well, I'm going to call President Salinas. President Salinas gave me the clearance that very same 31st of December.
Okay.
Oh. At one point, some of the friends say, well, why don't we have this thing before, and we can have it here at the UN headquarters. I said, no, it's very important, because it was Christiani's point, it's very important to have that in the region. And first in Mexico, and then we all go to El Salvador to have the big celebration there. But we want this to happen in Mexico, and that's the reason why we moved to Mexico and have the Secretary General. By the way, Boutros Ghali invited Pérez de Cuellar to be present, and as a gentleman that he is, as a good diplomat as he is, he thought that the light should be for the new Secretary General,
right,
not for
yeah,
him,
yeah.
And so he didn't accept the invitation.
Right.
We also made an invitation on behalf of President Salinas, but he told me, I'm no longer the Secretary General,
mm-hmm.
and the one and only is Boutros Ghali, so he's the one who's going to be there.
Right. Now, we wanted to look at the photograph that is in the book, Pérez de Cuellar's memoir, to identify some of the other people in the photograph who weren't identified beneath the picture there.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I mean, as I said before, I guess that it is extremely important that we recognize and give the credit to whoever deserves the credit. And I think that the four persons that appear behind the Secretary General, going from left to right,
uh-huh.
is the Ambassador Yáñez from Spain,
oh.
Juan Antonio Yáñez, Ambassador Jorge Montaño from Mexico,
that's you,
Ambassador Diego Arria from Venezuela,
uh-huh.
and Ambassador Fernando Cepeda from Colombia.
So the four friends
the
are
The four
right?
friends were, we were in fact the guarantors, so that's why it is amazing that my friend Pérez de Cuellar didn't give the recognition. As I said, we were representatives of government. It doesn't really matter our names. What is important, we were representing the four friends,
mm-hmm.
and the four friends were not included in the explanation of the who was signing, We were there, as I said, as guarantors of our country. By the way, this is Calderón Sol. You recognize he's Calderón Sol, the mayor of El Salvador.
Yes, to the far left there.
Later became president of El Salvador
until
a year ago.
Uh-huh.
Armando Calderón Sol, who was not part of the small delegation.
Right. That's really helpful, though, to have that clarification, because that will be lost in history. People will look at the photograph and they won't really know who the people are. So I appreciate your adding that. I wanted to ask you a few other questions. We've talked quite a bit about the leverage during the negotiations played by the U.S. and by Mexico and so forth. What kind of leverage, if any, did the Friends play during the implementation of the agreement?
I think that's a very good question. All along this process, we sort of kept saying that it was very important that once we signed the peace, that the next stage was extremely important. That is what we call the peace building. And peace building for us was mainly help the Salvadorians to develop their country, mm-hmm. mainly helping the Salvadorians to implement the agreements. And in fact, Mexico made an exception because we never participate in any peacekeeping operations with forces. We have a very strict rules about not sending troops into any other country, mm-hmm. Even if it's the blue helmets. You know, we have a tradition in our constitution that we respect dearly. But in this particular case with El Salvador, what we did is that we participate with police forces. Mm-hmm. One of our elite groups that are very well trained are the ones of the Highway Patrol in Mexico, and we send something like 250. Mm-hmm. It was very important for the Salvadorians to have Spanish-speaking people in the as members of the police in the transition. Mm-hmm. And but mainly Mexicans and Salvadorians are very much alike. They like each other, the music, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it was not only a problem of Spanish speaking, but also the fact that they were Mexicans and yeah. in a difficult role. And I think as a role, that as a whole, it was a success, that that group that we sent. And we also helped them to develop better links with the Inter-American Development Bank, with the IMF, and so on and so forth. Once again, Mexico was working very closely with the United States, helping them. Mm-hmm. Venezuela became involved in a lot of troubles in 1992 with President Pérez, mm-hmm. so he lost steam, mm-hmm. a lot of steam, and Colombia for internal reasons as well. But Spain, the U.S., and Mexico made tremendous effort. As I said, you know, I don't want to believe that the other countries were not really support. They were very supportive, but they had other pressures in their own agenda, and it was mainly the U.S., Mexico, and Spain that were very actively engaged in supporting the
city. Did Mexico or Spain or the U.S. Offer the El Salvadorians funds for the agrarian reform or redistribution that they were going through? Or I understand that in the demobilization camps there were some problems that arose. And
yeah. In fact, what we did, President Salinas created a mechanism that still exists that is called Tuxtla. Tuxtla 1, and now we are almost in Tuxtla 4. Tuxtla is a city in the south part of Mexico, in Chiapas, where Salinas convened the presidents of Central America to create a mechanism of how we can help each other, and mainly to help El Salvador in the peace-building process. I think that the Tuxtla mechanism has giving a lot of support to the Salvadorian process. However, I also believe that the Four Friends plus one and the international community as a whole has not been as supportive as everybody expected in El Salvador. I think that for one reason or another, economic conditions in the different countries and so on and so forth, I think that the Salvadorians have not received the support that it was committed.
It was
promised.
Oh, yes. Promise. Yeah.
I think that they have been left very much alone, you know, by themselves. Mm-hmm. Mexico has been making efforts. As I said, President Salinas and now President Zedillo have been working with this mechanism. Mm-hmm. But to be very honest and very candid, I think that it's short of what we were supposed to be committed. You know, the 4+1 and the European community and so on, so Japan, everybody who made commitments, you know, I think has failed to fulfill those commitments.
Yeah, and that's, it's really a shame that.
But I know that you have heard this before, you know, Salvo and so forth, you know, that they have so many lacks and that they have not been able really to overcome those lacks.
Now, I wanted to talk about a couple of the issues involved. We've been talking a lot about process. But you had been early on very involved in human rights. And one of the unique things about the agreement that evolved on El Salvador, that in fact the first agreement that was reached was on human rights.
Yes.
And it was even a reach before a ceasefire.
Right.
So how did that happen?
I think, in a way, you know, with the pressure of the UN, the pressure of countries like Mexico, Spain, and others, that it was very important to reestablish, you know, the human rights in El Salvador, you know, and I think both sides wanted to, because both sides were accused of violation of human rights, you know, and I think both sides wanted to prove and to show a better face to the others, to the world, you know, to the international community.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the reason why they accepted to have the monitoring of human rights there,
mm-hmm.
and ONUSAL became a very important instrument.
Mm-hmm.
For them to reestablish, they wanted to prove their good faith, and they wanted to receive assistance on how to establish the human rights in El Salvador, and they were prepared to train the police to accept the code of human, how to respect human rights and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, in a way, I would say that they accepted that even before you have a peace process starting, because they want to save face and to show that they were acting good.
Mm-hmm.
That for me is the main explanation. It sounds very odd to have a human trying to reestablish human rights when you don't have peace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that both sides understood very well that it was extremely important to have to have the support of the international community. I mentioned to you before, the FMLN and the FDR had always a very deep concern about what the international community think about us. You know? And they were not at all troglodytes, you know, caring less about the international community. They were very concerned about it. They were concerned about Geneva. They were concerned about the third committee of the UN.
Okay.
And obviously the government had the obligation to be concerned, you know, but
yes.
Let's say the rebels themselves
mm-hmm.
accepted that they want to comply with international law. They want to which is very unusual as well, you know, in any guerrillas, they couldn't care less, they want the power.
Yeah.
And this particular group, particularly at the end, were very concerned about how they are seeing us, because they wanted to sort of be eligible to be authorities, you know,
mm-hmm.
to be a government.
Yeah.
And if you behave like a troglodyte, I mean, nobody was going to respect you, you know. And so that's why they decided to give support to the human rights.
Was it also partly because they had been unable to reach agreement on other issues, like the reform of the military, and wanted to come up with something out of those meetings?
No, I would say that when the UN proposed to them, you know, the ONUSAL, they decided that that was also not only to prove to the international community, but to prove to the other side, okay, I'm prepared to do something. You know?
Okay.
I want to show you that I'm acting good faith.
Okay.
They had such a bad blood among themselves, you know.
Yeah.
After all, they were the same, you know. I mean, it was amazing. Sometimes you will find that three brothers were in one side and the other three brothers were in the other side, you know. And it was such a small country.
Mm-hmm.
It was a civil war. And for all practical purposes, it was a civil war. And So it was ridiculous, you know. I mean, you could see Alfredo Cristiani, they had been to school with several of the members of the leadership of the FMLN, you know. Mm-hmm. Or Margarita Cristiani had been friends with, or it's a cousin of, third cousin of this or the other, you know. I mean, they were mm-hmm. so closely interrelated. Right. But they also disliked each other a lot, you know. Yeah, yeah. After almost 20 years, I mean, they were, I mean, the separation of two sides were tremendous. You know? So I guess that for internal purposes, they want to show, yes, I want to show you that I want to do things. Mm-hmm. And for the international community, we are prepared to comply with international law.
Okay. Did they really think that coming up with that agreement on human rights would actually make a difference in how the peace process itself evolved? I mean, there have been books and theories that, in fact, by having ONUSOL there monitoring human rights, that it created a greater sense of confidence in the country itself, which then led to the ability to have a ceasefire. Is that a...
I think so. Yeah. It's a fair assessment.
A fair assessment?
Yeah, true.
Was that really anticipated when the agreements were reached?
I think so, yes.
They
yes.
understood that?
Yes. They were very clear about it. Okay. And I can tell you that because, as I mentioned before, in the 80s, I was in charge of, I was the Mexican delegate at the Human Rights Commission, and and they had a Jesuit who was the main advisor on human rights. And this Jesuit, by the way, was Mexican, and was my teacher here in Mexico many, many years ago when he was about to become a teacher, a priest. And for one reason or another, he went, like good Jesuit, went to the El Salvador, and later he became closely linked to the FMLN, and he was the main advisor, Padre Moreno, Father Moreno. Uh-huh. Father Moreno was going, moving from one place to another. Very articulate, intelligent fellow, who had always the right drafting, the right wording, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they knew very well that human rights was clearly, you know, a very important coin to use as exchange for
okay.
peace.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
why I guess that that explained, there are several explanations, but I think we have mentioned the three most important ones.
Okay, that's very good. Well, now we had talked quite a bit about the group of friends, and in your opinion, is that mechanism a useful tool? Can it be replicated? Can it be used in other processes, peace processes?
Yes, I think it's the answer. Yes, I think it's a very useful tool, providing that the parties concerned accept that. You know, not imposed by, like, let's say, by the UN.
Okay.
But the parties concerned will accept that their support is important. You know, your authority, your legitimacy, your moral authority comes out of the fact that both sides believe that you can be a good broker.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's important. Because and actually explain to me how this evolved, because there was a group of friends, or still is, in Guatemala. So how did that evolve out of the group of friends on El Salvador?
I think in Guatemala, obviously, you know, the example of El Salvador was a very important one. However, we're not talking about Guatemala now, but in Guatemala, you know, at the early stage of the process, we're always insisting that Guatemala and El Salvador were different, you know. And they didn't want any kind of similar kind of approach, but then they realized that, well, by the way, Mexico is also play a very key role. They realized that the four friends, or the five friends, or the ten friends can be a useful tool, mm-hmm. and that's why they accepted. You know, and, in fact, right at the end of '92, when we started with the negotiating process at the UN. I sat at the residence, Ambassador Pickering, with Roberta Menchú, that later became Nobel Peace Nobel Prize Rigoberta and the three important commanders that went to negotiate in the UN. The first negotiation took place towards the end of 92 at the UN.
Okay.
The first encounter of the UN. And obviously, as I said, you know, the Guatemalans were very reluctant to be treated like Salvadorians. They want a special kind of approach, a different kind of conflict, and so on and so forth. But I guess that going back to your question, yes, the friends really proved to be useful too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were involved in the Guatemalan friends group,
yes,
as well.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
And did they somewhat follow the same model? Did you meet in the Mexican mission with
That's correct. And the conversation took place in Mexico.
And the conversation took place in Mexico again.
Again, because the guerrilla groups that were collectively organizing the what is called the URNG, URNG, also had their site in Mexico City. I mean, that was where they were working. They were working here for several years, I mean, 20 years or so.
Well, I know that we've come to the
end. Do you want another question?
I've covered most of the things that I had written down for now, and but I just, if you had anything specific you wanted to add.
No, I think that, as I said, you know, I guess that the, as I mentioned to you before, I guess that the negotiations in El Salvador have proved to be one of the most successful pages in the history of the UN. And unfortunately, for one reason or another, we haven't repeated that model. And I guess that it is important to recognize that some lessons that you can draw from that process, the UN should use it in the future. You know, as I said, you know, the fact that the 4+1, with the support of the Secretary General, but obviously the support the 4+1 gave to the Secretary General all along the process is something that is necessary to stress, you know. And it was so important, that support, that even Pérez de Cuellar forgot to mention in his own memoir. Because
right.
He thought he was the one who did it, you know, but he didn't. He did it with the support of the 4+1, you know. I think that's when the UN can be effective is when it has the support of the actors, you know.
Right,
and
right.
If you don't have the support of the actors, then you're lost.
That's right. That's right. Because alone, the Secretary General does not have leverage.
The Secretary General have no resources really to, yeah. Whereas the countries' governments, you know, do have a clout, do have the influence to move things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you leave alone the Secretary General, then tomorrow you will call the Secretary General a bureaucrat. Right? What you need to have is a Secretary General that has full support. And who cares, you know, who takes the credit, you know. What is important is to achieve your targets. And your target here, in this particular case, is peace. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you taking the time.
No, it's a great pleasure. As I said, you know, I'm convinced that what you're doing is extremely useful. As I said, I haven't seen yet a good account of what, as you can see, and I'm sure, because I saw that in your eyes, that you have heard so many opinions, and probably some of them are contradictory, you know, I mean, probably, I don't know, but when you put together all these opinions, you know, as I said, a Mexican like myself, that probably some of my friends consider me not necessarily very friendly with the U.S., but I said it's very important to recognize,
yeah,
the role played by President Bush, by Secretary Baker, by General Powell,
mm-hmm,
by people, let's say, the other levels, people in Congress. I mean, when you have many members of Congress in the Senate, who played such an important role in this peace process, you know, and their voice was so important, their peace newspapers and so on and so forth. It's very unfair to read, I did it, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's so complex, so complicated, that nobody can claim I did it, you know.
Right.
So that's why, to be fair with history,
yes,
we have to sort of bring together all those who participate, one way or another, at one level, as I said, you know,
probably Colombia was not that engaged, but gave his name. President Barco was there, President Gaviria was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's more than enough, you know, and others had more to give. Okay, had more to give. Had an aircraft to give, or conversation with the generals of it.
Right.
That's when it becomes a successful international operation. You know? And I think that's for me the main lesson to go from this piece of
Right, right. Well, thank you so much.